Welcome to Turn the Page, the official podcast of the Syosset Public Library.
Hello, this is Jessica, and I'm here with
Barney.
And we are sitting with
James Cole.
And we are going to turn the page on Turn the Page podcast. Welcome to our podcast, James.
Well, thank you very much. I'm really happy to be here today.
So we have had you here several times. Would you like to talk a little bit about your area of expertise and what brings you to the library circuit first?
So first of all, I really enjoy coming here to the Syosset Library. We do a monthly kind of lecture discussion series where I come in with a constitutional topic and then open it up for questions and commentary afterwards. And one of the best things is just the breadth of knowledge and curiosity of the people that come here to the programs. And it's really, inspires me to kind of keep my game up and try and keep on top of their questions. But I always find that even when I leave and I'm supposed to be the person leading the discussion, I tend to learn something from their commentary and their questions too.
Well, it's great to have you here. And we find that also. I work in reference here, and the scope of the questions that we get from our patrons is really remarkable. I think today we were planning, this podcast is probably going to be airing President's Week, right, Jessica?
Yes, we're planning this for a President's Week.
And we thought it would be interesting to discuss the presidential line of succession and how things have changed over the course of history.
Now, just first getting into it now, Lincoln was the 16th president. He was the first president to be assassinated.
Right, yeah, Lincoln is the first to be assassinated, but there's a bit of a story before Lincoln. 25 years before Lincoln's assassinated, about 24 years, you have the first death in office, and that's William Henry Harrison.
Right, I was reading, so Lincoln was, I guess, the first, one that people really think about, but he wasn't the first president to die in office.
It's funny, actually, and not funny, but it's something that it's not a topic that we think of that often.
No.
But when I started thinking about it, I didn't realize that if you do the math, it's roughly 20% of our presidents have not finished their terms in office, whether by death or resignation in the case of Nixon.
Right.
A subject that we should be
I'm not sure if aware. Your research came up with this, too. This is a kind of a interesting tidbit that people can use on President's Day. For a while, there was something called the Zero Curse. So you have William Henry Harrison, mm-hmm. who was elected in 1840, and he doesn't survive the office. You have Lincoln, who's elected in 1860. He doesn't survive the office. You have Garfield, who's elected in 1880. He doesn't survive the office. 1900, McKinley, same thing. 1920, Harding, mm-hmm. 1940, FDR, 1960, JFK. So all of these presidents for 120 years, every one of them that were elected on a year with zero did not survive the office. The first to break the quote-unquote zero curse, if you believe in that thing, such a thing, is Ronald Reagan.
And
we know 2 months after he took the oath, he is shot, and we find out years later it was a very, very serious injury from mm-hmm. March of 1981.
That's very interesting. I feel like I've definitely heard a little bit whispers about the zero curse. Of course, you hear more about all of the, what is it? Oh, did you know that Lincoln had, what was it, a secretary named
the comparisons.
I've definitely heard more about that than the zero curse, but that is very interesting.
Absolutely.
But the founding generation, the framers of the Constitution, thought about presidential succession differently than any other office, largely because they knew they were creating an office around a single person. We do not have any type of succession law or order for any other office in the federal government. We don't have that for members of the House or the Senate or members of the Supreme Court, obviously because they serve on bodies that are more than one person. And the institution itself could survive with the people that are left in the wake of that vacancy. But the presidency, they knew, was different. So they create the presidency, and then obviously next to the president is the vice president. And then they start thinking about the aftermath. And in the original writing of the Constitution, and still law today, it says, well, anybody past the vice president will allow Congress to make laws creating the line of succession. And Congress, over the course of time, in a handful of instances, do pass succession laws beyond the vice presidency. We luckily, fortunately, have never had to go past the vice presidency.
Mm-hmm. The succession laws have changed considerably over the years. I think the succession laws have changed to a great extent over the course of the years from when they were first implemented. And again, these are not necessarily constitutional provisions, but these are legislative provisions that have been adopted, right? Correct?
Yeah, these are, you know, statutes passed by Congress. But as you mentioned, it's the Constitution that's authorizing them to pass those.
What does the Constitution itself say about succession?
So the line of succession in the Constitution itself is obviously president, then vice president. And then we have to go all the way to 1792, which is, you know, 4 years after the first presidential election. We're already in the second presidential election year. And that's when they first write their first succession law, which says it's president, vice president, obviously Constitution. And then they go to the Senate pro tem. And then they go to the Speaker of the House. And then it stops there as that 1792 law is written.
So how come they waited to do it? Was it just not something they were thinking about the succession at the time to really make a formal line?
Well, unlike a lot of our kind of current legislatures, it wasn't like they were doing nothing. I mean, they were passing.
Of course, and they were also starting, yeah. You know, the fabric of the country. That's a good point.
I know that's not lost on you, but I'm not sure what the specific delay was. But I mean, it could have just been something as simple as there were other things on their mind, more immediate, as you point out. But it's also the idea that. You know, it's something that they knew they had to get to, but it's just not something that was on the front burner.
Right, of course. And, you know, sometimes I think even those glaring, obvious things that you have to tackle, you don't get to them for obvious reasons. So the first president to die in office was William Henry Harrison. And automatically...
William Henry Harrison's death, like, creates a whole host of other questions. For every question that's answered by the Constitution, usually we get 10 that we have to answer. That's not answered specifically by the document. And his death creates a similar series of constitutional issues. So William Henry Harrison, the interesting thing about his death is that it happens 1 month to the day after he takes the oath of office. He goes out on March 4th, and delivers the longest inaugural address in American history.
And it was supposed to be very cold on
very
that
cold.
Day.
March 4th, 1841. And I guess he didn't listen to his mom. He didn't wear his coat. And he caught pneumonia. And 1 month later, he dies. And you have John Tyler, who was his vice president, steps up and says, I'm the president. And the members of the cabinet say, well, not so fast. The Constitution doesn't specifically say that the vice president becomes the president. It says that in the case of the death of the president, the vice president shall take on the powers and duties of the president. Mm-hmm. So it's not until way later, 1967, that we get that clause, in the case of the death of a president, the vice president becomes the president. But Tyler starts what's called the Tyler precedent, and that is the idea that if there is a death, removal, or resignation of a president, the vice president becomes the president.
So interesting. So Lincoln, just talking about succession in general, Lincoln was the first president to be assassinated, and he was succeeded by his vice president, who was
Andrew Johnson,
and he was impeached.
Right.
So that's just it was just kind of one of those things, you know. And he wasn't removed from office.
No, he wasn't convicted.
Not convicted, right? Yeah, I mean, impeachment might be another.
That's not even a topic.
It's very intricate, but you bring up a good point. I mean, with Johnson's impeachment, you have kind of in this moment this discussion about how someone becomes the president, and that's in his case through the death of Lincoln, but also how someone could be removed as president. And Johnson is the first to ever be impeached by the Congress. Tremendous power of the Congress,
which again was very interesting. And I suppose if the tides had turned a different way, there could have been another accidental president waiting in the wings.
Well, the interesting thing, another interesting thing about the impeachment of Andrew Johnson is that when Andrew Johnson was impeached, there was no vice president. So there was no provision in the Constitution until 1967 for filling a vacancy in the vice presidency. So whether we're talking about William Henry Harrison, whether we're talking about Lincoln's death, whether we're talking about McKinley's death, you go all the way up to 1967. And Kennedy's death, when Lyndon Johnson became the president, there is no vice president for a period of time until the next election.
Mm-hmm.
It's not until 67 with the 25th Amendment, where a provision is put in saying if there's a vacancy in the vice presidency, the president picks and the Congress approves. And just 5 years later, we're seeing, 6 years later, you're seeing Theodore Agnew resign.
Yeah.
Right.
And the interesting events that lead to that.
It's so jumping ahead, so that was in 1840. Around the 1840s was the first William Henry Harrison, and then you had Lincoln, and then jumping ahead to the 1960s, that it took them to really put this together. Now, the seeds of the 25th Amendment, was that suggested by the American Bar Association? I believe I was reading
the American Bar Association had some role in that. Largely, it was the work of a senator named Birch Bayh. Birch Bayh is an Indiana senator, mm-hmm. and in the 1950s, he's saying, hey, there's some problems here with our succession. it largely gets dismissed because Birch Bayh is a Democrat, and the sitting president is not only a Republican, Dwight Eisenhower, but he's the oldest man that had ever been president. And it was looked at as Birch Bayh was talking about presidential disability and succession as like a partisan attack against the oldest president, who was the opposite political party. So this gets kind of shelved. Kennedy comes in and he's the youngest elected president. And then they're not going to have that conversation because
he's young and he's healthy, right. And nothing's going to happen to that guy.
Picture vigor, absolutely. But it's his assassination that puts it front and center. Because now in the Cold War, you have a president that became president through the death of Kennedy and no vice president. Where what if something happens in this climate where moments matter? It's not like you wait for an invading army, starting with really the Cold War.
Mm-hmm.
And this urgency of the Cold War prompts the idea of fixing this kind of glitch in the Constitution. And the ABA, the American Bar Association, kind of jumps on board as being proponents of and assists with the drafting of the 25th Amendment.
So the 25th Amendment, what exactly does it say? And there are four sections to it.
So the 25th Amendment is one of the longest amendments. So we're going to go word for it. No, just kidding. the 25th Amendment says a handful of things. One of the things that it addresses, so there are four criteria in the original Constitution of like issues around presidential succession. One is death. I mean, that's clear cut. Someone is dead or they're not. Someone has resigned or they're not. Someone has been removed or they're not. But there's a word in the original Constitution that created a big question mark, and that's inability. In the case of a death, removal, resignation, or inability to discharge the powers and duties of the office. Now, how do you define inability? And that was what they were looking to correct. While they're looking at the death of John Kennedy, some senators are bringing up the idea of what if, you know, as grotesque as it might sound, what if he didn't die and he was maimed? What if John Kennedy, instead of dying, was in a coma?
Even
prior to that, Eisenhower had his heart attack, and was I think he kind of worked out an under the table deal with Nixon.
Right.
To continue to act essentially as president during any period that he was incapacitated.
Yeah.
And that was certainly not legislatively enacted.
Sure. Yep.
And FDR, who served the longest, most amount of terms of any president, you hear whispers that towards the end, you know, other people were really running the show.
Sure.
And Woodrow Wilson.
There you go.
The most dramatic example and the most salient issue that most people know about is the Woodrow Wilson example, right. In the waning months of his presidency, he suffers a massive stroke, and now we know essentially his wife.
We had our first woman president.
Yeah. His wife and an aide are essentially running the country, or at least running the executive branch. One other thing that you look at, if you look at almost all these kind of deaths in office, almost all of them, the outlier is Lyndon Johnson. Almost all of them occur very early in a term, within, in some cases, days. Harry Truman becomes president 82 days into Franklin Roosevelt's fourth term. That means he has almost 4 years with no vice president. Lyndon Johnson's a bit of an outlier. There's a year and 2 months to go, but most of them are very early. And that's a long time to go without that succession stability there. Again, luckily we haven't had to go beyond the first up in the bench, but once you start going past that, you're raising a whole host of other constitutional questions. Because one of the things that the Constitution says, when it gives the power to Congress to pass laws related to the succession, they say that president will be the acting president. So it's like another title. What does it mean to be president versus acting president? Well, we don't know really, because we haven't had to face that. So this helps to correct that by creating a vice presidency, 25th Amendment. It also allows the ability of the president to decide to temporarily give power to the vice president. We've had a number of instances where the president was going in for elective surgery and he signs over temporary power to the vice president, comes out of anesthesia, recovers, and then signs another letter recovering that power. There's also a situation created in the Constitution where they talk about where there is no president signing over power, the kind of JFK that's injured, not dead scenario where they can't sign it over, but they're still alive. And that is, they create a system where the president, the vice president, along with the majority of the cabinet or a body that is designated by Congress, can kind of seize power from the president in a crisis.
Just getting back to it. So with the vice presidential vacancy, what does the Constitution say about that now?
With the vice presidential,
let's say there's a vice presidential vacancy.
So since the 25th Amendment passed in 1967, we've had that twice. We had that when Spiro Agnew resigned in 1973. And then Richard Nixon was able to appoint New York's governor, Gerald Ford. Who's the member of the House of Representatives. Then a year later, you had Ford become the president when Nixon resigned. Then he was able to use that same Section 2 clause of the Constitution, of the 25th Amendment, where he would then pick Nelson Rockefeller to be. So, interesting thing is, in 1967, you have for the first time a clause added allowing for the vice presidency. Within 6 years, we're using it twice. And in 1972, Richard Nixon and Spiro Agnew got more votes than any other presidential and vice presidential candidates in the history of the country. Within 2 years, both of those positions are occupied by two men that did not get a single vote for either of them. They're both appointed to those positions. So it's kind of an interesting turn of events so quickly after the 25th Amendment is ratified. Mm-hmm.
Part of them, I got my thought back. Part of the succession issue, you know, you hear the Hollywood scenario where there's, and in fact, I think there was a Tom Clancy book where somebody flew a plane into the Capitol during basically decapitates the government. That issue is also addressed in the succession plan, where I believe there's got to be a designated person in the line of succession.
I mean, usually, generally when there are assemblages of the vice president, the president, and the cabinet, they do pick someone who is, as they call it, the designated survivor. I remember this being like front and center in the news right after September 11th, where there was the mass that was held in National Cathedral, and then the addressing of Congress on the days afterwards. And the idea was that we're going to keep someone away. I think generally the vice president was the one kept away at the time, but you always heard about these members kept away. The one caveat that they make sure that they do is that the person that is kept away, even if it's the Secretary of Agriculture, they make sure that they're at least 35, they make sure that they're a natural born citizen, and they make sure that they have been living in the United States for at least 14 years.
So they qualify.
Basic qualifications, okay. Yes.
So they thought that through.
So you had Henry Kissinger, who's Secretary of State, and he's in line of succession, but he would be passed over,
right?
Because he was not born in the United States, but not a natural born citizen.
That's very, very interesting. So, just in general.
Well, what I was about to say is that as much as this is a topic that we don't think about and talk about too much, we have today a brand new Congress with a significant percentage of it openly talking about impeaching the current president, and you think about the possibility of this all coming front and center again, depending upon how things go politically for him.
Well, you have had not just talk about, as you mentioned, impeachment, but you have had people talking about the 25th Amendment, and you know, you hear these, we're going to invoke the 25th Amendment as a way to kind of, I'm leery about the idea, and I think most constitutional scholars are leery about the idea of using the 25th Amendment as a way to kind of overturn an election.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, the idea of it was not necessarily to be used against somebody who you think is just performing poorly in office. Yeah,
it wasn't supposed to be a political tool. It was supposed to be a practical tool that we have somebody who physically cannot.
Even the impeachment clause.
Right.
If you go to the impeachment clause, that also was not designed to overturn election results. It was designed to remove somebody for some type of either bad behavior or malpractice in office. And it could be, doesn't have to be a crime. I mean, it is still, that's a political tool, impeachment.
Right.
But I think that we should be very reluctant and use those constitutional weapons judiciously, because anytime the opposition party is in Congress, we're just deposing presidents. I don't think that's a good remedy either. We have to make sure when we are using the impeachment clause that it is something that is so egregious that both parties, at least in some field, agree, like with Nixon,
right,
that forced his resignation.
Right.
I know,
because
I know that, what is it, Section 4, I know that there was some talk at some point during Reagan's presidency whether or not he had all of his mental,
right,
you know, whether
we know
he,
later that he has Alzheimer's.
Yes, exactly. So I'd heard that that was sort of floated around, the 25th was sort of floated around very lightly there, because some people didn't think that he had really just all his facilities together towards the end.
And that would be an example. I'm not sure if Reagan would have qualified or not, but where there is some type of issue.
Right.
What a lot of the critics who were talking about the 25th Amendment in relation to President Trump kind of missed in the reading of it was, no matter how you slice it, the vice president has to be signing on to that.
Right.
And
yeah,
there has been zero indication that the current vice president, or that George H.W. Bush back when,
right,
was,
yeah,
president,
that
were signing on to that.
It seemed very unlikely, but that
in
seemed
hindsight,
that seems,
right,
like, you know, like a situation that would have, had it come down to it and had it been proven, would have fit that a little bit. And then I guess, you know, going back to FDR, had that been there at the time,
sure,
people could have said, you know, he's physically not. His cabinet would have had to agree that he's physically not
able
to. Well,
the cabinet, or if the 25th Amendment was in place. So the cabinet, there is a bit of an out, though.
Mm-hmm.
The Congress can designate a group of people. So in the case of, let's say, Woodrow Wilson, they could have designated a group of brain specialists to say, is this person suffering from the results of a stroke? Is this Alzheimer's or dementia,
right,
experts,
right,
in the case of Reagan,
yeah,
if it had advanced that much while he was president, to kind of give the expert opinion from a group of people that have the ability to do that to the vice president. And maybe the vice president is evaluating this. The real fear, though, if you look at some of the notes back from when the 25th Amendment was being debated in the mid-1960s, part of the fear was, you know, a lot of professors, like constitutional professors, talked about the overzealous vice president, the coup attempt. One professor talked about the opposite, the vice president reluctant to act, because everyone's expecting the vice president to, at the first opportunity,
right,
jump onto the presidency,
right,
and they'll look overly ambitious. So for fear of looking overly ambitious, what will a vice president do? They'll step back.
Right.
And in the midst of a crisis, you'll have kind of a neutered vice president. So the fear there was that you have this other body pushing the vice president into a position that he or she might be reluctant to take for fear of looking overly ambitious.
That's a very interesting point. And, you know, I mean, I suppose that comes up when you look at just other other governments, you know, the person waiting in the wings to pounce. And I would imagine that a vice president wouldn't really want to appear to be that person.
Well, let's look at what Lyndon Johnson did. I mean, he only had a brief amount of time between
right.
when Kennedy was shot and when
yeah.
he was pronounced dead. But Lyndon Johnson wasn't moving armies. He wasn't, you know, sending the Navy across the Pacific in those moments. He was sitting on a folding chair in Parkland Memorial Hospital with the curtain drawn next to his wife. And once it was told to him by one of Kennedy's closest advisors, Ken O'Donnell, that you know, Kennedy had passed, it's only then that Johnson starts to act presidential. And a lot of what he initially did were nods to Kennedy. I want to make sure we're waiting for Mrs. Kennedy. Can you make sure that Bobby Kennedy is there? In doubt, there's a lot.
He had a lot of decorum in his
yes.
that's the point. Public
right.
decorum
sure.
in his choices,
yeah. Yeah.
And that's, you know, what the public perceives.
Sure.
I mean, really, you know, what happens behind the scenes, especially back then when we still had, you know, access to media, but not as much.
Right.
As we do now, you know, those are the images that people remember.
Yeah, and contrast that with when Reagan got shot, Al Haig standing in the microphone saying, "I'm in charge."
Well, it's interesting you bring that up. You know, Al Haig went to his grave, like, with that as the headline of his of his obituary,
yeah.
essentially. But if we read
exactly, it probably is not what he meant.
The question he was asked yeah. by the reporters was, who's making decisions here?
Right.
And he said, well, I'm in charge. I'm in charge here in the White House.
Right.
You know, anything that's important, I'll check with the vice president. You know, that's the order, the president, the vice president, the secretary of state. And a lot of people jumped at him saying, wait a second, you forgot the Presidential Succession Act of 1947,
yeah. Yeah.
which said it's the president, the vice president, the speaker of the House, the Senate pro tem, then the secretary of state.
Yeah.
But his question was not about what's the line of succession in death.
Right.
He said, who's making decisions? And if you look at it, he says, I'm making decisions in the executive branch. You cannot say, especially today, that when the president makes a decision or the vice president makes a decision, the next in line is the Speaker of the House. The executive branch, he was laying out, I mean, inartfully, unfortunately
right.
for him, it looked like it's been painted as this coup.
Right.
Yeah, right.
But I parsed that a lot in my class. Like, let's look at the language he said.
Yeah.
It's unfortunate.
And it clearly is not what he
right.
intended.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
Yeah.
But it will, unfortunately.
Perceptions.
Perceptions, exactly what he's remembered
so.
For. Well, I want to thank you very much once again
thank
for coming to
great.
Talk to us. And I would love to have you back.
Please, I would love it. This is great.
Thanks so much for coming in. It's been fascinating. Not only this discussion, but I actually attended your program earlier today, and that was also
thank you very much.
Well,
it
was wonderful.
Happy President's Day to everybody. And I hope
thank
everybody
you.
Is doing what I'm doing, a big cake for President's
Day.
Enjoy. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
You're very welcome. Thank you. And we are going to close this chapter of
Turn the Page.
It's time to close this chapter of Turn the Page. Join us for the next episode.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Turn the Page, the newest chapter of the Syosset Library. I'm going to start over.